It's all yours. Yeah.
Brilliant.
Okay, so in the beginning God created. We've thought about the part of that sentence that had to do with God. Now we're going to talk about creation. And once again, I want to try and explain how I think the ancient Near Eastern background illuminates this theme for us. So we'll get going without further ado and state the obvious point first. That the first thing that a book like Genesis tells us is that the cosmos in which we find ourselves is indeed God created. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, which simply means the world, everything that makes up the reality of our cosmos, not only the earth upon which we walk, but also the sky in which we see the stars and the planets. All of that, the heavens and the earth, is a creation and not something else. And if I had said that last night, you may not have been particularly struck by it. But saying it now in the context of what we've done, you immediately see that that's actually a fairly big claim. Somebody created. There's nothing self-evident about that in a way. It's not actually what most ancient people believed, right? There was no somebody doing the creating. Now, what are the implications of this? For example, here's one. The world in biblical thinking is therefore not eternal. It has a beginning. And although Genesis doesn't get into this, other biblical texts say it has an end. Although, paradoxically, the end is also a new beginning, but we won't get into that just at the moment. We live in a world that once came into being and one day will pass away. And that idea is no doubt very familiar to you. But of course, it is not necessarily what lots and lots of people have believed. And of course, Tony was just mentioning Hinduism and the whole idea there of what is ultimately real is actually the eternal and all-embracing Brahman. So what is ultimately real is eternal in that sense. And it's the whole cosmos that's eternal. Aristotle himself actually thought that the world must be eternal, which is a whole other interesting line of thought there in terms of who's influencing the Greeks. So in Genesis, we have a beginning, and in other parts of the Bible, we have an ending. So we are involved in something that, structurally speaking, is a story with a beginning, a middle, and an end. The other obvious point, but I want to say it out loud, just because it needs to be said, is therefore that we're dealing with a personal matter. Somebody created. A person created. And once again, that is very different from what you find in the East, in religions like Hinduism. But it's also very similar to what you find in Plato, actually, who conceived of ultimate reality in impersonal terms, as did Aristotle. But for Genesis, it's a personal author who authors this story. So a couple of starting points, kind of obvious in a way, not to be taken for granted, though, actually, when we measure this story against other ones. Now, from the point of view of biblical faith, that is why there is an order to the world. We talked about order and chaos earlier on. And notions of order and chaos are not unique to the Bible, but the reason given for the order is unique to the Bible. It's because there is a personal God who is good, as we saw earlier on, that the world is structured in such a way as to allow life to flourish. Planets do not necessarily possess this kind of order, and in fact that's an understatement, because the truth of the matter is there is no other planet known to us that possesses such an order. So far as we know, this is the only one. And, of course, admittedly, that's so far as we know, but nonetheless, it is, I think, a significant thing to say. This is the only world we know about that displays the kind of order that allows life of this kind to flourish and, indeed, allows this event to be happening in all of its many dimensions. Genesis does know about chaos, of course. We begin with images of chaos in Genesis 1, do we not? Where we have the pre-existent form of the universe is actually formless. There's a wonderful bit of Hebrew, tohu vabohu, that's how it's said in Hebrew. Formless and void in the old King James English. So there's no form, there's no shape, right? And there's emptiness. There are no inhabitants to fill anything. So no form, no design, no inhabitants. And the language that's used here is actually reminiscent, really, of other parts of the Bible where the authors are talking about the desert, you know, as a howling wasteland, or the sea as a great, you know, expanse, dangerous expanse, chaotic expanse. Have you ever noticed, by the way, just how negative the Old Testament is about the sea? It's very interesting, and I think it must be related to the fact that the Israelites were very poor seafarers, which is in itself related to the fact that, I really am digressing here, that there are no deep water ports in ancient Palestine. The deep water ports are further north, which is why the Phoenicians sailed all over the Mediterranean. The Israelites did not. And every Israelite escapade in the sea ends badly. Think of the book of Jonah. You'll get the point. So, anyway, that's a digression. But it's related to the business of the metaphor being used in the way it is, right? The sea is a threatening, dark place. And this image of the primeval deep, you know, the primeval sea over which the Spirit of God hovers. We don't quite know what he's doing there, but anyway, the point is threat. So that's the kind of that's where we begin. And out of these raw materials, God begins to fashion order. And we find in these 6 days of creation that the problem of shapelessness is solved, first of all. Shape is given to all the different structures. The problem of emptiness is then solved by creatures being supplied for all of these different spheres. So you have both those problems identified at the beginning are dealt with. And there is a kind of progression in terms of scale, which is indicated by the number of words used in creation. You may have noticed that by and large there's a progression of the number of words used in the creation of each part. So you get this sense artistically of it rising to some kind of culminating point on the sixth day, which is the day of human beings. And not surprising that should be the culminating point, because of course it's what all this means for all creatures, certainly, but for the human beings who are doing this reflecting in particular. So it's not surprising. So the order we see around us, all the complexity and wondrousness the psalmists keep on rejoicing about, all of this is attributed to a person. It doesn't arise by chance. It's not just a matter of the evolution of the cosmic egg, you know, or some such thing. There is purpose in this. That's what our biblical authors tell us. Now, moving on, and we've said this once or twice, but let me come back to it and say a bit more now from the other point of view. The world that we're talking about, although it is made by God, it's created by God, is not itself divine. Right? And we've stressed that point. To put that another way, the world is made by God, it's not part of God, if I can put it that way. I mean, every metaphor is going to run out of steam at some point when talking about these things, but we have to find ways of talking about this clear sense of the transcendence of God over against creation. There's a marked difference between these two realities. In Genesis 1, this is communicated using the metaphor of speaking. It's interesting, isn't it, that God speaks creation into being. And if you think about that metaphor, it does actually carry with it the idea that God is over here speaking and over there something is happening, and there's no connection in a way. You see what I mean? And if you use a metaphor like pottery or farming, which our texts go on to use later, there's always the risk of misunderstanding that contact, as if there might be some continuity of substance or whatever. The metaphor of speaking actually allows you to talk about this in a way that stresses distance, right? So God speaks, things come to be, and it's only once that's established that the language relaxes into the business of making things out of the ground and so on and so forth. You need both sorts of language, but you certainly need the language of transcendence. Now, as we were saying earlier on, this is a very different view to the general notion elsewhere in the ancient world. We've talked about this business of the process through which the one becomes the many. It's really separation and division within the one that's the crucial thing, and the gods themselves are the process, part of the process of that separation, which then leads to the identification of those gods with natural forces. And in all of that, there is significant continuity between the gods and the world. You could say it this way, that in fact we're all made of the same basic stuff. Right? There's a genuine divinity of a very direct sort. And of course this helps to explain why in these religious systems, typically, and this is certainly true of the ancient world, you have such an emphasis on things like empathetic magic and ritual. Because if indeed you are part of the same stuff, in principle, there are ways of manipulating other parts of the stuff by what you do in your part of the stuff. Do you see what I mean? Fertility religion generally, where you try and make sure it rains by doing stuff, is premised on the idea of continuity of the sort that I'm talking about. Whereas, of course, in biblical thinking, you can certainly talk to God. That's a personal, relational way of being. But what you can't do is what the prophets of Baal tried to do on Mount Carmel. Do you know the Elijah story? Where he gives them first go, and they don't pray. What they do is they dance around the altar, slashing themselves with knives and getting into a terrible frenzy. And what they're trying to do is, of course, they're trying to force Baal's hand to make the god. And then what does Elijah do? Do you remember? He goes around and pours water over the altar. Now, why would you do that, do you think? I think you do that to make it clear there is no natural point of contact here. There's going to be no natural explanation if this bonfire goes up, right? So he pours water over it, then he prays, and the fire falls from heaven and consumes everything, right? It's a very interesting example of the difference in worldview. So, whereas a lot of ancient Near Eastern religion, therefore, is a case of manipulation of reality by experts such that you can force another part of reality to behave as you would wish, that's very alien to the biblical notion of prayer, although it's not necessarily alien to the practice of prayer, which is a whole other seminar. So, there's no continuity. You remember we said that the heavens and the earth are not manifestations of divinity in that sense, right? The heavens do declare the glory of God, but the sun is not a sun god. You see, it's a very different way of talking. And I've mentioned the Elijah story a number of times, and another place in the Elijah story where that becomes clear is slightly later, where you remember he gets very depressed because of what Queen Jezebel says to him, and he flees all the way to the south of the land, and he ends up being led back to Mount Sinai. And there's a great big storm while he's in the cave. You familiar with this story a little bit? It's very interesting what we're told there. We're told that there was this huge storm, natural phenomena, and the Lord was not in the wind, the Lord was not in the earthquake, the Lord was not in the fire. Why would you think the God would be? Well, now we know, of course, why you would think naturally God would be, because it's what all the other folks actually thought. So the story goes out of its way to make it clear that although God is there, God is not in these things. And then you remember God communicates with this still, small whisper. It's a very relational, in-your-ear kind of business. So that story, again, is illuminated, I think, by the background that we have been looking at. So if God is to be found anywhere, it's in this whisper. It's not in all these huge natural phenomena. Another way in which this comes into play very interestingly, I think, is the way in which in Genesis 1 the sun, the moon, and the stars occupy very humble positions. I alluded to this earlier today. You know, they're simply called lights to light up the heavens. Of course, we noted, I drew attention to this god Shamash earlier on, the sun god, and there was a moon god called Yarich. And, of course, they were very important gods, The stars were held to control human destiny. It's interesting that in Genesis 1, these bodies are described at much greater length than anything except the creation of human beings. If you look where the emphasis lies in Genesis 1, when it's not on human beings, it's on the sun, the moon, and the stars. And there's a reason for that, because you have to go out of your way in biblical thinking to put the sun, the moon, and the stars in their right place, because most people don't believe that. It's intriguing to me that Genesis 1 actually avoids using the normal words even for sun and moon in the chapter. And if we ask ourselves why that is, I think the reason is this, that the sun god is called Shamash, and the Hebrew word for sun is Shemesh. The moon god is called Yarich, and the Hebrew word for the moon is Yariach. The verbal similarity is just too close. It seems to me the author has even avoided using the words in case accidentally he should evoke this notion of divinity. So they're just lights. There's another reason, I think, why the lights are there, and we'll get to that in a second, but that's one of them. So this is a big come down for the sun, the moon, and the stars, essentially, right? They're in a context. So creation, obviously, for the author of Genesis 1, creation is not to be worshipped. That's the bottom line. It's not divine. There's separation from God and the world. And this marks out the biblical worldview from those surrounding worldviews. Certainly those other people believe the gods to be personal, although they believe the one to be absolutely impersonal. It's interesting that the Hebrew Bible actually goes the other way. It sees much of the world as being kind of impersonal, right? So rocks are just rocks, and so on and so forth. But the ultimate reality is profoundly personal. The one is profoundly personal. So it's the other way of looking at it. So, the cosmos is not divine, dot, dot, dot. Why is the dot, dot, dot there? Because you have to say something else if you're not going to make a mistake. The cosmos is not divine, but in biblical thinking, it is sacred. Okay, so what do I mean by that? What I mean by that can be explained in this way. It might at first seem to us that if the world is not divine, this would lead to a devaluation of the world in biblical thinking, right? A kind of hierarchy. Now, in fact, that is not the case. Because even though the world is not divine in Hebrew thinking, nevertheless, it is a sacred place. It's the place in which God chooses to make himself known to the Israelite ancestors. It's a place that many texts tell us is to be revered and looked after out of love and respect for the Creator and also for the creation itself. And I just want to dwell on this point because I think this is rather important, particularly in a contemporary context where the Judeo-Christian tradition is broadly, quite broadly, blamed by people who care about the planet essentially for creating the circumstances in which we can take the planet to the brink of extinction, right? So there's some very famous essays written, you know, blaming the Judeo-Christian tradition for the ecological crisis. And the argument typically goes, well, the trouble is you've placed all the divinity elsewhere, the world has become devalued, so what do you expect? You're going to see it plundered and ravaged and so on. And it's all the Judeo-Christian people's fault. Well, I think this results from a misreading of the Bible, or not even a reading of the Bible at all, actually. I think it actually arises from this rejection of Platonism earlier on, confusing it with Christianity, because the Bible itself makes it absolutely clear that the world is a sacred place. And the primary way in which this is clear in Genesis 1 is the way in which the metaphor of the temple or the tabernacle shows up in the Genesis creation account. Earlier today, although I didn't really labor on this point very much, I want to just belabor it a bit more now. I did mention, though, earlier on, that ancient Near Eastern temples were often designed to reflect the structure of the whole cosmos. Do you remember we talked a bit about that, macrocosmos and microcosmos? So temples were supposed to be mirror images of the cosmos. It's very interesting, then, to notice the various allusions to temple worship in Genesis chapter 1. And here we go back to this business of the lights that I was mentioning. It's not just an avoidance of Shamash and so on. If you ask yourself, where does that word for light appear elsewhere, this word ma'or, you will discover it is almost always used elsewhere in Hebrew of the sanctuary light in the tabernacle. That's the association of it to the reader of the Hebrew text. The tabernacle, in case you're not familiar with that concept, is the kind of movable temple that the Israelites carried around with them when they were in the wilderness and after the Exodus and so on. So the sun and the moon may not be gods on this view, but that doesn't mean that they're religiously insignificant. They function like lights in the temple. Similarly, we are told in chapter 2, verse 2, that God finished his work in creation. And I've just represented the Hebrew there, both in transliterated form and in Hebrew, because I want to show you this text about the language used when Moses finished the work on the tabernacle. And even if you're not a Hebrew specialist, I hope you can see that the wording is virtually the same. So the construction of the tabernacle echoes the construction of the cosmos and vice versa. And then, of course, there's the matter of the image that's placed in creation. You remember we talked about the image being placed in the temple. Who is it who is placed in the garden? It is somebody, gendered people, made in God's image. So the image is placed in creation. And there are lots of other examples of this same kind of thing that I don't have time to get into just now. Anyway, to sum all of that up, it is pretty clear that what we have in Genesis chapter 1 is really the story of the building of a cosmic temple by God. The story of creation is deliberately told in such a way as to evoke temple building. In fact, it's interesting that in the ancient world there's a marked similarity between cosmological texts on the one hand and temple-building texts on the other. They're very similar by literary genre because they're both about the same thing, right? The one mirrors the other. Even in this business, somebody was asking about the 6 days earlier on, the significance of that. It's interesting that ancient Near Eastern temples were often dedicated in ceremonies that lasted for 7 days, at the end of which God rested in the temple, took up residence, began to rule. So when you ask what's going on there, I think that's what the illusion is of the 6 days. If it's to anything at all, it's to that, I think. The same basic idea applies in Genesis chapter 2. I mean, to the modern mind, temples and gardens may have little to do with each other. But earlier on, you'll remember, I said that major temple complexes in Mesopotamia had a ziggurat, yeah, tall tower of steps, and also a garden, symbolizing fertility and order. And the temple itself, in fact, was often really viewed as incorporating within itself a spring, a primeval water source that went out from the garden to water the four corners of the earth. Now that's very evocative when you get to Genesis chapter 2, is it not? When you get to Genesis chapter 2, you discover that the garden in Eden had its entrance on the eastern side. That's exactly where the entrance to the Jerusalem temple was. That entrance, you'll remember, was guarded by cherubim. Right? And of course the cherubim are a pretty dominant artistic feature of the Jerusalem temple as well. So you've got the garden with the entrance on the right side, as it were, you've got the cherubim, you've got the foliage of the garden represented in the Jerusalem temple. You remember Solomon's artistic work was all about pomegranates and stuff, kind of flora and fauna. Earlier I mentioned this idea of the great bronze sea in temple courtyards all over the ancient world. You find in Solomon's temple an impressive sea there as well, which also I think relates to all of that stuff. a puzzling passage otherwise. It becomes clear on this basis. Ezekiel 47 envisages the building of a future temple in Jerusalem. And we're told that out of this temple, and I'm quoting, from under the threshold of the temple toward the east, there's a river of life that flows out of it. And, you know, that's not a matter of normal geography, if I can put it that way. That's really capturing this notion that the temple stands for something bigger. It's actually a picture of something else, if you like. So this primeval river idea. The food in the garden, of course, is also represented in the tabernacle and temple by the bread of the presence that's left out. There it symbolizes provision. And of course, we have a tree of life in the garden, and in the tabernacle we have a branched lampstand with floral motifs and so on, and later the 10 lampstands of Solomon's temple. All of this is quite evocative, right? Then we get the following quite clear set of verbal connections. In Genesis chapter 3, verse 8, God, we are told, walks in the garden in the cool of the day. In Leviticus 26, God promises that he will put his dwelling place among you. I will walk among you and be your God. Exactly the same Hebrew form, and in fact quite an unusual Hebrew form at that. And finally, what are the image bearers supposed to do in the garden? They're supposed to work the garden and take care of it. Literally in Hebrew, to serve it and to guard it. Shamar and avad are the two Hebrew verbs. This is the language of the tabernacle. So I've got the Genesis language at the top, the tabernacle language at the bottom. What are the priests to do in the tabernacle? They are to shamar and avad just the same. So this is religious language, right? It's a religious duty to look after the garden that God has planted. All of that to say, the cosmos is not divine in biblical thinking, but it is sacred. It is to be thought of as God's temple cosmos, where God lives with us and walks with us as he walks in the Garden of Eden. I think this is a pretty obvious case once you begin to multiply these parallels. Okay, related to that then is, of course, the notion, or one of them we explored earlier on, that the cosmos is evidently, in this view of things, good. Genesis 1 goes on and on about that. Good, good, good. Very good. It's a place of God's blessing, as we saw, a place of beauty, as we saw. So it's not just a place of order, it's a place of beauty and goodness. All of that is not a matter of chance, says Genesis. That's also a matter of God's care and provision, and indeed God's ongoing care. We talked earlier on about the gods having to maintain order. In the Old Testament, creation is not just something that happens back then, it also happens every day right now. So it's ongoing, right? So I think of Psalm 65, where the psalmist says to God, in the present tense, you care for the land and water it. You enrich it abundantly. The streams of God are filled with water to provide the people with grain, for you have ordained it now, today, right? It's not just back then. It's not the deist view that you wind up the clock and let it go, right? This is a creation where God is present and providentially caring, and as some of the Psalms tell us, even providing food for the lions when they roar, you know, and stuff like that. It's very hands-on. So, just to put this a different way, in other words, the world of creation for our biblical authors is not a problem to be overcome. There are problems in it, but the world of matter is not a problem to be overcome. And we've alluded to this notion now a couple of times. It's really important to get it, though. The common ancient Near Eastern view is, of course, that reality is ultimately impersonal and not personal. And, of course, that is actually very much the kind of fundamental idea of Eastern religious thought in general. It's the idea that lies at the heart of Buddhism and Hinduism and so on. And the purpose of religion, then, is to be reabsorbed into this impersonal one, right? The world is a problem to be overcome. We have to escape from the wheel of existence, right? In all of that way of thinking. And the world of matter, therefore, is certainly not thought of as intrinsically good. It's an Eastern idea. It certainly turns up in the West, and we mentioned Pythagoras and Plato altogether. Platonism eventually kind of morphs into Gnosticism, in which matter is not simply a problem, it's positively evil, and you have to escape it as sparks fly back to the flame, as it were. Our Canadian artiste Joni Mitchell on this side of the world, she's a nice little song that's rather Gnostic along these lines about, you know, we are stardust and we all have to get back to the garden. Do you know that song? Very interesting. Very Gnostic, actually. So you have a deep suspicion of the world of matter, whether in the Eastern or the Western tradition, and over against all of that, in Hebrew thinking, the world is not a problem to be overcome. It was not a mistake. It does not trap us here where we ought not to be. It's not a place of dim shadows and illusions viewed from a cave. None of that is actually true of biblical thinking. The world is a wonderful place, created to be just the right place, a good and beautiful place for the flourishing of creatures. The many do arise from the one, but our destiny is not to be reabsorbed back into the one. This is a very distinctive worldview, therefore, both in ancient times and also in modern times, it seems to me. Now, we all know, not just from reading our Bibles, but from our experience, that although the world is not a problem, there are problems within it. The cosmos in biblical thinking, in Orthodox Christian thinking, is not just good and beautiful, it is at the same time fallen. It is in various ways spoiled. There are things that intrude into this world of goodness. And of course the book of Genesis goes on to describe the world's fallenness as well as its goodness. And really this is put in terms of harmony and broken harmony, it seems to me. God's design is that all of our relationships should be right. Our relationship with God, with each other, and indeed with the rest of creation, right? So if we're in right relationship with God, we ought also to be in right relationship with other people, which sets us free to look after the planet, which is our calling, right? To be gardeners in God's garden. Genesis 3, though, tells us about the entrance of moral evil into our experience. Being cut off from God, we are inevitably then cut off from each other. We are disguised from each other. The metaphor of hiding, the metaphor of the fig leaves, you know, speaks to this matter of division among human beings. And this then disables us from looking after the world. And in Genesis 9, you have that picture of all the animals fleeing now in front of human beings, which is a very different picture from Genesis 2, where they all parade happily, you remember, to be named. It's a very different kind of reality. So it's a good world. It reflects God's glory. Even the fallen world, in Psalm 19, we are told, the heavens declare the glory of God, right? So it's still a world like that. It's also a fallen world into which evil has entered. What is God doing in the world? This takes us back again to the earlier part of today. We talked about God's rescuing activity, God's redeeming activity. The plan of rescue is outlined first in Genesis chapter 12. We saw that with the Abraham story. He leads them out of Mesopotamia, which turns out to be more than just a physical journey, as we've seen, because really you can see the whole story of Israel as being a story of being led out of Mesopotamia, intellectually, culturally, physically, spiritually, and so on. And then that promise of redemption, of blessing on all nations, is picked up in the rest of the story. The prophets develop it, and they look forward to three transformations that relate to the three alienations of Genesis chapter 3. So quite a helpful way of reading the prophets, I think, is to line up their promises with the three problems we talked about, right? So the God-human relationship, the human-human relationship, and then our relationship with the rest of creation. The prophets speak about fundamental transformation in the human relationship to God. They speak about a world in which the problems of that relationship are removed through forgiveness and cleansing and a new heart and a new spirit. They talk about the reconciliation of human beings to each other. And they certainly talk about the transformation of creation itself. And here we have to notice, of course, that one of the implications of God's commitment to the whole of creation is, and the commitment therefore to the world of matter, is that the prophetic vision is not a vision of us escaping somewhere else. The prophetic idea of redemption is that the whole of creation is restored. We have the language in the prophetic writings of God making a covenant with the animals, which is a beautiful idea. And famously in Isaiah, of course, the wolf lying down with the lamb and all of that. The New Testament, of course, fills all of that out and tells you exactly where Jesus fits into that whole picture. But the Old Testament prophets already tell you a lot about that. Okay, so that's the big picture. And, of course, the most pressing question from our point of view is, what does all that mean then in terms of our understanding of ourselves and what we're supposed to be up to? If this is the big story, if this is what the Bible teaches about how we're to think about creation, what does all of that mean? Now remember that in the ancient world we were talking about earlier, human beings are really of very little value, and the value they have is derivative of the gods, essentially. So the gods are the main show in town. Human beings are derivative. Most of their lives are not great, and they don't have any hope really for the future either. In biblical thinking, of course, we're in a very different world. We're not in a world where the gods have needs. That's the most fundamental thing. Remember I said earlier on that these gods are very much like us, and they certainly have needs, and they get very grumpy if their needs are not met. So the whole premise of all that ritualistic system I was describing is that the gods must be kept happy in various ways, with sacrifices and rituals and so on. And if you don't do it, there's trouble for the city-state. There's trouble for the family. And this all leads one author to say this of Mesopotamian religion in particular. This is a direct quote from John Walton. Mesopotamian religiosity was made up above all of a centrifugal feeling of fear, respect, and servility with regard to the gods, whose needs people were expected to fulfill, whose orders were to be carried out with all the devotion, submission, generosity and ostentation that were thought to be expected by such lofty figures. You get the picture. This is a very low view of human beings then. We're right at the bottom of the social heap, and for most of them, that's all that could be expected. This rather negative view of human beings is reflected in later literature. One case I came across quite recently was Mark Twain. Man was made at the end of the week's work when God was tired. There's not much to be said for us. Now, the book of Genesis takes the diametrically opposite view. The God that we are dealing with in the book of Genesis and elsewhere in the Bible does not have needs like human beings. We talked about that earlier on. God does not create human beings to meet his needs. His presence in this temple cosmos does not depend on the satisfaction of those needs. In fact, the world is not created for gods at all in the biblical worldview. The world is created for creatures. And they don't need to feed the gods. God blesses them with food. Everything is turned on its head, in fact. None of these creatures is created as a slave of the gods. That includes human beings. In fact, the Bible says that the position of human beings is incredibly exalted. Over against Mark Twain, human beings are not made on the sixth day because God got to it late, as it were. They're made on the sixth day because there is this accumulating idea. Remember I talked about the number of words given? As we know, now we see where that comes to roost. They're given all that space because they have to be right at the center of the plan for the whole plan to work. Human beings are going to be God's representatives to look after the rest of creation. So Genesis, in an absolutely revolutionary move, takes human beings out of the role of simply being priests looking after the divine image in the temple, and makes all human beings, not just priests, the images of God themselves. You see how radical that is, right? So we're no longer serving the image. We ourselves are the image of God, both male and female. We are the images of God that live in the temple. We are the people made in God's likeness. Right? You with me so far? That's how we are. That's how we remain. The entrance of evil into the world does not affect that notion, right? We haven't lost the image just because of sin. In fact, Genesis 9 verse 6 makes that very, very clear when it says, oh, there's the image of God, by the way. It's the true picture. Genesis 9 verse 6 says this, whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, because in the image of God has God made man, right? Human life is so precious that you have to mark its removal in a very serious way. So the image of God is not gone anywhere. It still defines who we are. This is a very, very different view to the view that we were looking at earlier on. And indeed, we then go on to ask the question, okay, so if we're not slave labor for the gods, what is our job? And I've touched on this. Genesis 1 tells us two things about our job. First of all, Genesis 1:26, let them rule over the fish of the sea and so on. So we're to function as kings. So we don't have one king now, we're all kings. Right? So it's a kind of democratization process going on here. One God, none of the rest of us are gods, therefore we're all equal. Basically a very revolutionary idea. It took a long time for the implications of that idea to work out. Right, but really I think modern Western society is an eventual kind of product of that thinking, although because it's lost its theological moorings, it's also quite problematic. But that idea of one God and then all the rest of us are mates, which I believe is a very Australian idea, I've been told this, is a fundamentally biblical idea, right? This idea of ruling is very important. It's a very exalted idea. You remember Psalm 8? I mentioned Psalm 8. What is man? Says the psalmist asked the question. What is man? And the answer in Mesopotamia was virtually nothing. Right? What does Psalm 8 say? What is man? You made him a little lower than God and crowned him with glory and honor. Very interesting. Glory and honor are two attributes of God elsewhere in the Bible. So we're not divine, but boy, are we close. You know, there's that idea of flirting with dangerous language in order to make the point that we are extraordinarily precious and important. So whereas Mark Twain was wrong, I think William Shakespeare was actually right. What a piece of work is a man, how noble in reason, how infinite in faculties, in form and moving, how express and admirable, in action, how like an angel, in apprehension, how like a god. That's much more, I think, what the Old Testament thinks than the rather cynical Mark Twain. Now, of course, the language of ruling could be misunderstood. It could be, you know, potentially misunderstood as giving us permission to do what the heck we like. Of course, since we're delegates of God, that's not really open to us. But just in case we misunderstand, we're also given other images of serving. So the priestly language we talked about, you remember? Looking after, guarding, tending the garden. Both of those ideas are important, and we mustn't lose sight of either of them. But that priestly duty, it's religious work, if you like. So what is our vocation? Our vocation is to look after the garden on behalf of the owner of the garden, who actually is not somewhere else, but walking with us in the garden. So This is not some agenda for exploitation. This is quite the reverse. It's a call to serving the earth, essentially, and looking after it. There's a creation mandate, if you like, to operate on behalf of God in this way. This language, and we'll come back to this in a couple of weeks' time, because when we hit the story of Israel, we'll discover that the people of Israel, when they are called out as one particular people to do God's work, are also described as being priests in exactly the same way, right? At Mount Sinai, when we have the Ten Commandments being given, this is what it says: although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests. Now, what do priests do? They mediate God's blessing to other people, right? So Israel is called out not for itself, but to do the will of God in the world. So that story of the people of Israel called to be a kingdom of priests, the relevance of that story to us, that's the substance of our second weekend together, in fact, which is why I've taken this occasion to kind of segue into that. Before we get there, of course, we have the Friday event we've been talking about, which is going to be largely an opportunity for question and answer, and any difficult questions you have are welcome. So the title of that session is Violence and Other Hard Stuff. So I'll say a bit about how to deal with difficult passages in the Bible, and then we'll open it up for conversation. And before we might want to mention the Monday evening event in Narrenburn as well, if people are interested. I'll be speaking in Nerida at the back. Wave your hand, Nerida. There she is. She's organizing an event there where I'll be developing actually some of these ideas about the Old Testament idea of people and land, and how that's important for Christian theology as well. So there are going to be further opportunities to get into conversation, but for the moment, that's probably where I want to finish up. Are we going to have questions now for a bit, or how are we doing for time? I lost my watch at some point in that whole enterprise. Okay.
We're sort of on time.
Yeah.
You mentioned the resources.
Yeah. Oh, you want to talk about that now? Shall I
just
do that
briefly,
now?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Good. And then we'll see how the time... Maybe we'll have time for more conversation now. So resources. Tony asked me to, give some suggestions, because inevitably one of the great questions whenever we're involved in these conversations is, well, where might I go if I want to read up, more? So I produced this relatively brief bibliography, which you've all seen and you all have. Initially, we were going to go through it and say stuff about it. I actually feel that's almost redundant, because I would just be saying, oh, look, there's what I wrote, So I don't think that's very helpful. I do want to say one thing, though. I have chosen to adopt a risky strategy, because I believe in taking risks, right? So let me just tell you, I do not necessarily agree with every word written in these books I'm recommending. I haven't recommended them because I think they're safe. I've recommended them because I think they are incredibly stimulating and important, and your engagement with them, would be a worthwhile thing. But it doesn't mean that I necessarily agree with everything, and I expect we all have to use our own sense of discrimination in dealing with that. But the first three are really about the intellectual cultural context. John Walton, I've referenced John a number of times today, a very fine ancient Near Eastern specialist who teaches at Wheaton College. So he's written very helpfully on a number of aspects. And then he edited a very large five-volume set called the Zondervan Illustrated Bible Backgrounds Commentary, the purpose of which was to tell you all the stuff you don't normally find in commentaries about the intellectual cultural background. I actually contributed to the volume on 2 Kings on that. So they're all on that whole business of this morning's first session. Then we have a couple of books on Who is God? Walter Brueggemann, I find to be one of the most stimulating writers at the present time on Old Testament theology. I think, like all of us, he has his blind spots and so on, but very stimulating, I think. And James Cool's book, The God of Old, which talks about how we read the Bible. And then on the theme of creation, Bernard Anderson, Stephen Bohmer-Prediger, who really tries to take all of this creation idea we've been talking about and ask about creation care and how Christians should or should not respond to what we might loosely call the green movement. Should we be in there? Should we not? Why? And then Terence Fretheim, once again, very stimulating writer, and a bit like Brueggemann, don't necessarily agree with everything he says, but I do find him to be a very stimulating writer. So that's really all I do need to say about that. The Regent College website, we do have a website. Tony said, tell the people, you know, what's on there and how to access it. I don't ever access it because I teach there, right? So I'm on the inside of that. But I am told by people like Rod that a lot of the stuff on there is pretty good. And it's not difficult to access. And you can actually take whole courses, you know, and download things from there. And there may well be lots of things there that you would find interesting as part of the follow-up to what we're doing. So that's all I need to say, and you can now make a judgment on where we are and what we want to do.
Well, I mean, we have had a good time of questions, and I don't want to prolong it, but if there was a burning question without having an extended question time from the last session, perhaps we should just... Mm-hmm. Someone might want to throw up an idea. Michael's got...
Maybe showing a bit of childishness, but there's a good Canadian show called Stargate, which I've almost enjoyed my family watching.
Yeah.
Because it does talk a lot about the ancient Near East worldview, the Egyptian worldview, Ra, or
Opus. Yeah.
Do you have any comments on that expression of the arts?
If you get me started on the way in which science fiction reveals the gospel, you'll never get me stopped, right? I mean, I find that to be a very helpful way. I mean, I was doing a lecture up in Wellington in New Zealand the other, just last week, and it was about this business of, you know, does matter matter? And because typically most people in churches, even, you know, students are even studying the subject matter, don't really have much of a grasp of the starting points. I gave them a quick 15-minute introduction to Greek philosophy. And, you know, so you've got your Stoics, right? Well, they're the Vulcans from Star Trek, right? And you can go through and on, and then you've got this this kind of idea of dualism, you know. Star Wars, there's the one force with the dark and the light side. And you can go on and on. So all of these are fair game, and it's a lot of fun. And you can even throw in a book like The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which I often do. He has some wonderful lines in that book, which are relevant to these. You know, like the Gnostic view that the world was a mistake. There's one passage in The Hitchhiker's Galaxy, I'm going from memory, which says something like this: in the beginning, God created the world. This is generally regarded to be a bad move and to have made many people very angry. Which just captures the Gnostic view bang on, actually, to be honest. So thank you for that light-hearted question at the end of the day.
We meet again in a couple of weeks, and I think this has been a fantastic start. I would encourage you to invite any of your friends who you think would benefit from similar fare. Let's just thank Ian for a lovely time.
No housekeeping, Sue, that's the end? Okay, good.